Hi, this is Steve at MyParaSpace. You can visit us on the web at www.myparaspace.com, and you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Can't get enough Ghostly Talk? To go to addunderground.com and click on Slack and Radio every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time to check out past shows of Ghostly Talk.
Hey, this is Grant Wilson from Ghost Hunters. You might want to check out the Taps Paramagazine at tapsparamagazine.com. And you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Okay, man. This is...
You know, you used the term earlier.
Okay, go ahead. Just have a field day.
No, I'm not going to have a field day with that. I already teased enough on that. You used the term earlier, classic ghostly talk. This is it. This is what I used to get out
of. This is the kind of stuff I
live
for. I
still get this kind of stuff out of shows, but this is absolutely amazing because I'm drawing lines, I'm learning. You know, and this is what I like to do.
Well, here's the thing, Dr. Nichols, and before we went to break...
Oh, yes, we are on with Dr. Andrew Nichols of www.parapsychologylab.com.
Oh, yeah, and there's still a lot more to tackle here. Here's what I wanted to... Before we went to break, Dr. Nichols, as you well know, we kind of started getting into sleep, and the last thing we kind of said was that, obviously, you know, when you dream, when you're in the sleep state and you're dreaming, your body...
It releases chemicals
to paralyze you.
And it paralyzes you so that you cannot act out your dreams. Well, that's a defense mechanism, right?
Yeah.
It is a defense
right.
mechanism, and it's there to protect you and other people so that you can't, you know, mm-hmm. if you're running from the zombies, you're not really running.
Into walls and fish tanks and stuff like that.
And you're not going to harm yourself or other people. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you're I don't know, starting fires. You're not starting fires. We don't want that to happen. So our bodies have a that's a physical defense mechanism.
Exactly.
Well, your mind, of course, has psychological defense mechanisms. And you've heard people, you know, I put that right out of my mind, or that kind of thing. You can compartmentalize
things
and block. You can, mm-hmm. you know, you can do certain things mm-hmm. in order to maintain some semblance of sanity.
Yeah.
And evidently, and I hadn't thought about this because I have seen people and known people who had PK style experiences, psychokinesis kind of experiences, and you can't do it all the time, and you know it wasn't a controllable thing with you know my friends or but they would have these experiences, and I had never drawn the line that okay there because this power
mm-hmm.
this ability mm-hmm. is potentially dangerous, the mind very well better have.
A defense mechanism
from us unleashing it onto the world.
At will, under our own control. That's the biggest thing right there, is that the ego can't take that over, where it would be potentially dangerous.
Right.
That's the idea that really, I think, just kind of put us all on the floor.
It's not really a new idea. If you remember the old science fiction movie, Forbidden Planet, that's what destroyed the Krell, you know, monsters from the id.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Well, here's the thing. That's not true. That's
what was in the movie.
Fictionally speaking, it was
now,
true.
You're
okay. I made my mistake the last half hour. You go ahead and do your thing this half hour.
Before we talk about
I wanted to ask
Dr. Nichols. Here we
Dr.
go.
Dr. Nichols.
I know. I feel like I'm on a panel. And this is great.
Poor guy's getting grilled.
Okay. A member of the professional Parapsychological Association, founding president of the Florida Society for Parapsychological Research, director of the American Institute of Parapsychology, right?
Right.
Okay. And I told you already, these are institutions I read over and all kinds of wonderful work. And here's the thing. I really think we need to be able to classify hauntings and poltergeists and all these different things with better clarity We need, like, for example, one of the very first things we said was, it's a poltergeist, but you know what? It kind of bleeds into hauntings, and hauntings can bleed into paranormal, and then there's these little one-offs. And what about a clear, concise, scientific description, a language like science has to describe these events and be able to, describe them and categorize them? Why can't we all get together at some conference or something and sit down and say, okay, we need a language to be able to describe this stuff? Because right now, when you talk about the Bell Witch, you have absolutely no clue what to call it. When you talk about the Danny Poltergeist case, you kind of have an idea. But the certain things were this way and certain things were that way. And that's not as concise as science is, for example.
But sometimes, and in fact, we do have these classification systems. However, I think that they tend to be overused because many times what you're really doing is trying to affix a scientific sounding label to something that you really don't have a clue what it is.
True.
I think it's going to focus on the common. Now, types of these classifications type, vigilant, type, delusional types, precognitive, which sometimes thoughts. And so genuine hauntings, which seem to have intelligence behind them. But I think even the classification system like that is rather arbitrary because there are so many areas where they overlap, and it's always almost impossible to distinguish exactly which classification is very precisely in those or the classification.
Well, I don't know.
Paranormal occurrence.
I don't know, because here's the question that I have out of that. Is it because of our own early stages of investigations on this entire realm, or is it so our own misunderstandings of certain things, or is it because it just really is impossible to classify these things?
Well, I don't think it's impossible, or I wouldn't be doing this kind of work. I do believe that given the appropriate changes in science and technology, we will ultimately understand these things. And I'm not a supernaturalist. I'm actually a materialist, which actually surprises a lot of people. I don't believe that parapsychology is the study of spirits and demons. It's the study of the mind and the interaction between the mental world and the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that these things are not supernatural. They're paranormal in the sense that they sometimes, not all, but sometimes go beyond what can be explained through contemporary models of science or psychology.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that given the appropriate changes in science, we will be able to understand these things. And in point of fact, I don't think it's as great a mystery as people seem to think it is. I this may seem rather arrogant on my part, but honestly, 30 years now, and in my opinion, I could be completely wrong, of course, but I think I have a pretty good idea of what this is all about. It's only the details of the mechanism involved that we don't fully understand. But the psychological mechanisms are pretty well understood. The physical mechanisms are more difficult. And I think that those types of discoveries are not going to be made by parapsychologists who are psychologists like myself. Now, there are some parapsychologists who are primarily physicists, and those are the type of folks that are going to understand the physical mechanisms involved. My goal is to try to understand the psychological mechanisms involved, and I think they are pretty well understood.
Okay, well, then that's the thing, too. Like I said, I don't think there's going to be ever... That's just my opinion, too. I don't think there's ever going to really be a cookie-cutter-type paranormal occurrence. I think there's still going to be these bleeds back and forth between all these different types of hauntings. The mechanics,
right.
And I think that's what we're really interested in. That's what we look for a lot, is the mechanics itself.
You're not going to find these things walking around in a house with a $200 magnetometer, from Radio Shack. These things are highly complex quantum events that are going to be, if the mechanism is ever fully understood, it will be, the mechanism will be discovered, in my opinion, by physicists working in, multi-billion dollar particle accelerator laboratories, not by fellows walking around with, Dr. Gauss meters in their hands. So, that's just my feeling about it. I've done that myself for many years, and I have not found that to be a very fruitful line of investigation.
Well, while that kind of investigation may not solve the entire, or may not solve the mystery, right?
Yeah.
Or the completely complete the equation or anything like that. I think that what that does is that definitely gets a lot of people thinking about this stuff and you know go out and look for a paranormal occurrence.
Well,
Capture it on tape. I'm all for it because I want to see it.
Unfortunately, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I agree with you. I truly am conflicted. I'm very ambivalent about the current. The current fad of paranormal investigation, the amateur paranormal investigation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very ambivalent about it. On the one hand, I'm very gratified that so many people are interested in this field. But on the other hand, the methodology used and the conclusions drawn are generally so sloppy and so unscientific that I think that little or no progress is made by the majority of people engaged in these activities. And in fact, what they do tend to do is muddy the waters a considerable amount. They muddy the waters to the extent that mainstream scientists are even less likely than they were before to take parapsychology seriously because there are such gaping holes in the logic of most of the paranormal investigators' conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it more difficult for legitimate parapsychologists to gain any credibility, and we've worked for over 100 years to gain that credibility. So I have real mixed feelings about it, and I've tried over the years to educate and offer workshops and training seminars and so on to a lot of the amateur ghost groups, and one of my original goals was to try to unify these groups in some way and to teach them real scientific methodology. But what I find is there's a tremendous amount of resistance to that. Most of the time, the groups that I deal with, they're interested in what you have to say, but they really aren't interested in modifying their methodology or their assumptions. And most of the time, I think their assumptions are fallacious. They're just they're in error. And unfortunately, therefore, the results that they produce are virtually worthless scientifically. So that's just, again, you know, at the risk of offending some people, that's how I feel.
I'm not offended at all. I think it makes a whole lot of sense to me.
It's a very realistic viewpoint.
Very realistic.
And I've been out there, and I've taken the photos with the orbs in it. I've taken I've gotten excited about it. But what really gets me excited is not so much when I take a photo with an orb in it, okay? That doesn't get me excited. Although it does get me excited if I take a mist, you know, because I just don't seem to get those very often. But we were out at this one haunted or reportedly haunted site one night, and it was a bridge, and it had these finger marks along the bridge, and as if people were trying to climb up out of the water onto the bridge, right? We tried to wipe away the finger mark. We'd never seen them before, and I've never seen them since, right? We tried to wipe them away. We tried to create these fingerprints that we couldn't do it with our own very living hands. You know, I regard that as a paranormal manifestation because I could not do anything to recreate that. Now, did I get in there with a particle accelerator and study the makeup of the bridge itself? No. But I did notice something. I did observe something.
Sure.
And the very first thing in the scientific method, number one, is observe.
It is. But the problem that I have with it is, number one, although you observed it, so it definitely would be, from your perspective at least, it would be a paranormal experience. That doesn't necessarily make it a paranormal phenomenon,
right?
Because it only is a paranormal phenomenon if it cannot be explained. Just because the individual who's observing it can't explain it doesn't mean that it's unexplainable. It could be that it is explainable by someone with the appropriate knowledge. I don't know if that's the case or not.
Mm-hmm.
But you did definitely have a subjective paranormal experience, which I think is very important, and I think from a phenomenological standpoint, that perhaps is the most important thing, is to record your observations. But looking at it from a more empirical or objective scientific standpoint, the question would have to be, what did you learn from that? Did you learn from that? Okay, let's assume for a moment that it was a genuine paranormal phenomenon. What then does that tell us?
It's not so much what I learned from it is how much it made me think. I mean, it made me really consider a lot of other, you know, cases that I'd been on, or a lot of other phenomena that may happen that I may be actually missing. I mean, so I think it did open my eyes a little bit.
Well, that sounds
good. So from a subjective standpoint, it was an extremely valuable psychological experience for you.
Yeah, I
believe
so.
I think that's
so.
Very important. I do not mean to minimize that in any way. I think that's extremely important. But you have to realize that from the standpoint of objective scientific methodology, it's not something that is likely to bear any fruit. And so that's the problem because,
right.
You know, when you get hundreds and hundreds of cases, which maybe you do on your show and mm-hmm. in your personal investigations, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
but you have to be very selective about what you actually choose to investigate because the vast majority of these things require, in order to do a comprehensive investigation, you've got to invest a tremendous amount of time, energy,
mm-hmm.
and money most
mm-hmm.
of the time. And so as a parapsychologist, I have to be extremely selective about what I choose to investigate because the very first question you have to ask yourself is it investigable? You know, can it be investigated?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way that this is likely to be resolved? And if it's not, then it may not be worth investigating. Now, that doesn't mean it's not an important case. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have a profound impact on the people who experience it. And it doesn't mean that those people still do not need help in some way. They need to have the appropriate counseling, the appropriate advice. But in terms of understanding the mechanisms involved in these experiences, most of the cases that come my way, and I think come the way of most other investigators, really do not offer much in terms, because most of them are secondhand anecdotal accounts.
Absolutely.
That cannot be confirmed. And most of the physical evidence that is offered by paranormal investigators, such as photographic evidence of orbs and mists, so-called EVP, and EMF readings, I mean, those are the three main lines of evidence
mm-hmm.
that are basically offered these days. And I think all three of them are bogus. I think all three of them basically are worthless.
Well, they're worthless for the overall scientific you know, the scientific research
well,
going
for
on.
For a grand objective viewpoint. To try
it's
and,
not going to help us understand a haunting.
Yeah, it's not going to.
But what if they're not real at all?
Well, that's a big problem.
Then they're truly worthless, not only from the scientific viewpoint, but from the standpoint
from
of
an observation.
Maybe
yeah.
deceiving themselves by convincing themselves that they're taking pictures of spirit orbs when, in fact, they're taking pictures of dust particles and moisture droplets. Which I think there's a tremendous amount of evidence now to show that, even though there's still many people who strongly resist that. But they're just, you know, I have looked at thousands of paranormal photographs, and I am not at all convinced that ghosts can be photographed. I think that people see them, but I believe that they are seen in the mind's eye. They're the subjective experiences, and they may have an ESP component to them. But that they are essentially subjective experiences. Now I'm talking about visual apparitions here, not
right.
Not
yeah,
poltergeist
yeah, yeah.
activity.
Right. What
I
about?
I haven't seen any good evidence that either EVP or paranormal photography shows us anything at all.
EVP is a big thing. We talk about EVP a lot on the show here. So that's something I know we're both interested in that.
Being an audio kind of show,
well, yeah,
that sort of lends itself
that helps us.
To
that helps us out a lot. Yeah.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing, and I've listened, I've combed the internet and downloaded tons of EVP.
We get
clips,
tons of EVPs in our
I've
mail.
Heard it on, you know, the Coast to Coast AM show. You know, it's pervasive. You know, there was that hideous movie. I don't even remember what it was called.
White Noise.
White Noise. Oh, worst movie on the planet, and it was me. And that's my own opinion. You know, that's not the opinion of the station you're listening to the show on. Okay.
Oh yeah, we got to start saying that now.
I know now that we're all syndicated and stuff. But
we have to start doing a disclaimer before every show now. Every stupid joke we make is not the opinion of the station.
Right.
All right, now we're done.
The thing is, I was physically there. We were on now, and part of my fascination with the paranormal is also the history that you get. We were actually are physically there for. We were on a covered bridge in Indiana. We were inside this covered bridge, old covered bridge in Indiana.
Yeah, and our listeners are really familiar with this.
There was a recorder running.
This begs to be discussed.
And we were actually talking about the experiment that you're supposed to do. You're supposed to pull your car up, and you're supposed to
honk
three times or flash your lights three times or whatever, and then the ghost of a little girl is supposed to try and climb in the car with you. Mm-hmm. And there's a backstory for it, and I can fill you in, but it's, you know, that doesn't really
apply
at the mm-hmm. moment. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. Well, while we were talking about the experiment that we were going to do.
Actually, I thought we were talking about where we were going to go next.
No, we were talking about, because I said to Bonnie, you know, how do you want to do this? And okay. she goes, what do you mean? How do you want to do this? And I meant, do you want to pull up the car, or, you know, how are we going to, you know, do the experiment?
Mm-hmm.
And then we did the experiment, we left, right? Everything was great, until we get this phone call from the guy who owned the recording device. And he says, there's a voice in there. So he sent it to us in our emails, and sure enough, and I was physically there at this place, and I could be sitting in court, and I would say that I did not hear this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on the tape is the voice of a little girl saying, I want to go.
And Dr. Nichols, you know, what we'll do is we'll make sure we get you the links so you can download this audio.
If you want to hear it.
I want to hear it.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
The thing, and
what that does
mm-hmm.
is not so much, it doesn't prove that the paranormal exists, right?
Absolutely not.
It doesn't help even further our understanding of the physical method, other than there are qualities on the tape that are interesting.
Well, yeah.
For example, the voice does echo.
We were inside a covered bridge, so obviously, Dr. Nichols, the acoustics in there are very bouncy, they're very noisy, and that's one thing we noticed. I had anticipated that
a ghostly voice inside that bridge would sound flat.
Well, yeah.
But no, this has echo to it. It has acoustic properties, which I did not expect. So I did learn from it. But being there, being at the site while this was recorded, and then hearing it later, you know, when the guy rips it off the little recorder thing,
mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a powerful experience.
It's quite a feeling.
And it really does start you considering these things. Isn't it possible that one day somebody, some young, maybe he's like, he or she is 16 or 17 or 18,
mm-hmm.
and they're all a bunch of goofballs, and they're running around, and they're partying, and they're in high school, and they check out one of these haunted spots, like this covered bridge in Indiana, or the ghost light, or this or that, and they're doing all this stuff, and it's kind of interesting. And then they think, you know what, I want to become a parapsychologist. My glass is indeed half full, by the way. I want to be a parapsychologist, and they become a and they're the one that figures it all out and solves the equation. You know, I mean, this is possible that it could start with this underground upswelling of interest in, yeah, it's backwoods paranormal research, okay, but you know. It could start with that.
It's, but, you know, and again, I do not wish to minimize the importance
mm-hmm.
of the subjective aspect of paranormal experiences. And in fact, in my view, that is the most important aspect of it. That's far more important than any of the physical or allegedly physical aspects of it. The problem that I have with it is, you know, well, number one, how many times can you listen to voices? You know, how many orbs can you take a picture of? You know, eventually you're going to say to yourself, okay, I've got a whole album full of orbs here and 16 shells full of EVP tapes. Now, what exactly does all this mean? You know, at some point you have to try to put it together. You know, EVP isn't new. People have been studying this since the 1940s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it has been studied under laboratory conditions and obviously tens of thousands of allegedly paranormal photographs have been studied. And the reality is that there just doesn't seem to be a whole lot we can learn from it. Now, if we could demonstrate conclusively that any of these voices were from the spirit world, for example, or if we could demonstrate conclusively that any of these photographs were of an actual spirit, then that would be an incredibly important find. The problem is you can't. You cannot rule out all other possible explanations, and the reality is that we have to assume, at least if we're rational thinkers, we have to assume that the simplest explanation is more likely than a complex explanation. Now, we know that that's not always true, but it serves us well in our day-to-day life to assume, you know, if someone, if you have a good friend that comes to you and says, well, I saw Elvis in the mall. I mean, there are three basic possibilities. The person is crazy, or they're lying, or they saw what they said they saw.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they saw what they said they saw, then you have to say, well, was it hallucination? Was it someone that looked like Elvis?
Yeah, wasn't it an impersonator?
Is Elvis actually still alive and going to the mall? Or was it the spirit of Elvis? You see, and you can never fully eliminate the more likely prosaic possibilities. And the reality is, if the person is someone you know, and you know them to be honest, and they have no reason to lie,
mm-hmm.
and you have a pretty good idea that they're not crazy,
yeah.
then it probably was not a hallucination, and it's probably not a lie. It's probably something that they're reporting exactly what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
However, most of us would not assume that because they're telling the truth, therefore they must have actually seen Elvis in the mall.
Mm-hmm.
See, most of us would assume that they're mistaken. That they're mistaken.
Yeah.
It's not malevolent. It's not lying. It's not crazy. It's just mistaken.
It's just mistaken. Right. Exactly.
And people, you know, psychologists know that human perceptions are mistaken all the time. And in terms of photography and radio recording equipment, there are so many variables and so many things that can interfere with the normal operation of these devices that there is absolutely no way that you can ever say, yes, this is definitely whatever, particularly when someone else can produce an identical effect without any assistance from the spirit world.
Well, I'm glad.
And
I'm glad.
I'm positive James Randi, for example,
yeah.
can. You know.
Well, and I'm glad sure. that we've never, you know, as far as the piece of evidence that Doug was referring to, we've never once went out and said, this is proof of the paranormal. It's Miller time. Let's go out and party. We don't,
yeah, we're done. Yeah.
No, we've always said, hey, take it for where it is. We think this is a pretty interesting audio. Check it out and see what you think about it, right? That's very important. You know, I think we should just blow through the break.
I think that's a good idea. Let's blow through the break
because, I mean, this is stuff, I mean, you make some very, very solid points, and I think these are things that need to be said nowadays with, like you refer to, that there is an upswing of people going out there and doing these investigations.
I like the warning in there. Dr. Nichols, the thing is, you're saying that, okay, you're running around and you guys collect all this evidence of, you know, what you consider paranormal.
Yeah.
First of all, it may not, you know, warning. It may not be paranormal. You may not be able to explain it, but someone might be able to.
Well, yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Another warning, don't convince yourself.
Absolutely not. How many times have we said it on this show, Doug, where
yes,
I tell people,
have.
You want to see,
you
and I'm
see
sure Dr.
Ghost.
Nichols is going to agree with me wholeheartedly on this, if you want to see ghosts, I will show you ghosts.
Yeah, you can run in and set up a situation where
I'll get your brain going so
your
fast.
Your brain is
yeah.
going, and then you can see a squirrel and say, "Oh my gosh, that was a ghost."
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
absolutely true.
It was a little
yeah.
it was a little squirrel specter. It came across. I mean, I don't know.
That was a ghost.
You know, I'll turn it aside.
Well, I think that people should keep as a foremost investigator should keep foremost in their mind that until we eliminate all of the possible things that could not be paranormal, you will never, ever figure out what actually is paranormal.
Exactly.
How long do you think that's going to take?
Not as long as you would think if people are willing to adopt a more rational approach and are willing to learn a little bit about scientific method. I think that it is much more likely than people think it is.
See, that totally surprised me.
The problem is, I think psychologically an awful lot of people really don't want the mystery to be solved.
That
they
totally
don't,
surprises
they don't
me,
want
though.
It to be solved.
Do you know what? That makes absolute sense. Because I know there's a piece of me, and you know how you were saying, well, I'm conflicted about this current phenomenon of ghost hunters because they're running around, they might be deluding themselves, but at the same time, you've done it, and it was interesting, and yes, you do get these subjective little pieces of things that happen to you and you're interested in, and then that makes them think or investigate. So it's all a good little exercise, right?
But I think, and I agree, and I absolutely think that's very important. I think that people should make every effort to experience the paranormal for themselves, and that's what I recommend that people do. And
mm-hmm.
frankly, I think you can toss away the magnetometers and the cameras and all the other equipment and just go out there and try to experience it. And I think that's going to be far more interesting and far more scientifically relevant than most of the other so-called objective evidence that are presented.
Well, and some of the most impressionable people we've talked to, as far as, like, you know, interesting ideas about this field, say the exact same thing, Dr. Nichols. They're like, look, this is not something that you're going to be able to figure out with a Gauss meter. You're not going to be able to
right.
do it. There's so many variables, like you said, Dr. Nichols.
It is.
You're not going to be able to figure this out. A lot of times, if you just go out there and try to experience this and open up your senses and open up your emotions and open your mind to it, you may have more favorable results. Now, unfortunately, you're not going to have a picture to prove it or some audio to prove it or anything like that. But a lot of this, I find, even this EVP we talked about, it was a very personal thing for us. Because, like I've been saying from the beginning of this show, back in 1832 or whatever. That,
4 years ago.
That it's your word against the world when you get something like this.
That is
the bottom line.
So what? You know, I don't have an iota of evidence of any dream that I've ever had. I have no photograph of it. I have no recording. But, you know, I wouldn't trade some of my dreams for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. That's same true. Here. Same
you know,
here.
You know, there's a reason these things are called psychic experiences, because they occur psychically. That means in the mind. Just like dreams are psychic experiences, ghosts are also psychic experiences. And I think if we accepted them as such, instead of trying to objectify them so much, then I think we'd all learn a lot more from them, frankly.
One of the things that I often laugh about is we had Troy Taylor on the show once. And we asked him, at the time I thought it was kind of funny. I mean, it just was rolling, you know, the conversation was going, and I just outed with it, and I said, have you ever seen a ghost? And I've laughed at myself ever since. But do you know what? I want to ask you that question. Have you ever seen a ghost?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay.
There you go.
Cool. Well, I mean,
twice, as a matter of fact.
Well, okay, now, as far as your experience is concerned, I mean, if you care to elaborate, I mean, what did you see? I mean,
what? Yeah, because you've got a burden, actually, Dr. Nichols, because you can have the experience, and you know what okay, I had this experience, I saw this thing, and yet you've got in your mind all the science behind it, battling with the subjective experience. So it's got to be more difficult for you to see a ghost than for me, because I did see one once. I almost killed it, but I almost ran over a ghost with my car, but I didn't know it was a ghost at the time.
It's just driven me mad a long time ago.
But how do you get by that, like, because you've had this subjective experience, which not, you know, people have had these experiences, but not everybody. And then, but you also have the scientific background and the scientific knowledge to say, whoa, how can I put that together? And it's got to still have some missing pieces. So what do you do with that?
Well, it certainly, there will always be mysteries of the mind, you know, because the mind is the most incredibly complex structure in the known universe. So, of course, as a psychologist, I'm fascinated with it. However, I understand also as a psychologist that everything we experience is perception, that none of us experience the world as it actually is. We experience a combination of sensory input, which is then combined with expectation, belief, and predisposition, and the result is a perception that we label as reality. But the truth is that none of us ever experience objective reality directly. We always experience it indirectly through our perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know as a psychologist that perceptions can easily fool you. That you know, any magician can tell you that perceptions are easily fooled. I know that just as a dream can be an incredibly realistic thing to the person while you're in the dream, and yet it's not something that can be documented. You know, in a sleep laboratory, we can record your REM periods, we can record your theta brain waves, but we can't actually record the dream itself. We're still reliant upon the person's subjective anecdotal experience to describe what that dream was. And I think that ghosts are the same way. In fact, to me, both ghosts and poltergeists are really a kind of externalized dream. I believe that paranormal investigators, and this again is my personal opinion, should spend a lot less time studying EVPs and should spend a lot more time studying dreams, because I think if you understand the nature of dreams, at least to the extent that we're capable of understanding it right now,
mm-hmm.
then I think you will understand a lot more about ghosts.
Wow. No, I mean, this is, I'm really, it's a lot to take in, but it all makes sense to me, though, too. I mean, there is, because one of the things you just said, Dr. Nichols, was just this. I mean, you go out into the field. Let's say you want to go out and research the paranormal as far as what we, you know, the grassroots paranormal type thing that we talk about here on the show a lot. You go out, you catalog 10,000, you know, spirit photos or, you know, supposed spirit photos. You get about 400 racks of tapes with EVP collection on there. And what do you do from there?
That's right.
I mean, really, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm not down.
What you do is you start analyzing the experience itself. You start looking at the ghost experiences as if they were dreams. You learn the fundamental premises and fundamental principles of dream analysis as practiced by any psychologist or psychoanalyst. Mm. And you once you learn those principles, you start applying them, as I do, to ghost experiences. And if there is enough information, if it's not just a one-time situation, which there's not enough data to be able to do this, but if you have a long-term experience where a family or an individual has experienced numerous things over a period of time, you can actually look at that and analyze it as if it were a dream, and you can trace it back to its origin. You can understand where this is coming from. I understand what the ghost is now, because the ghost always is symbolic. The ghost is symbolic, and it represents something. And so your duty is to find out what the ghost represents. And if you find out what the ghost represents, by the way, you can then exorcise the ghost, which I have successfully done over 100 times.
Wow.
So that's the key, in my opinion.
Do you believe in life after death?
Personally, I don't. At least not in terms of personal survival of personality.
Okay.
Survival of consciousness. I take that back. Survival of consciousness. Because I make a distinction between personality and consciousness. Personality is how other people see you.
Mm-hmm.
So personality may survive death, just as, for example, if you rent a John Wayne movie at the video store, that's an example of survival of personality. You can plug that in and you can see John Wayne, how he looked, how he talked, how he acted. You can learn a lot about the personality of John Wayne by watching that video.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no consciousness there. The video retains many aspects of Wayne's personality, but it is not Wayne himself.
Right.
And so I think you have to make a distinction there between survival of consciousness and personality. Many hauntings do suggest the survival of personality. In other words, people see things which are associated with one who is deceased,
mm-hmm.
and there are personality aspects which are identifiable as being associated with that person. But there is no good evidence, in my opinion, of survival of consciousness. And so therefore, as a scientist, I have to say that I am not at all convinced that my consciousness will survive the death of my brain.
Well,
but some aspects of my personality might.
Well, that kind of throws the hole, because, I mean, my impression initially before this show was that a poltergeist is more of a conscious spirit. You know, obviously, we have historic references that point to it. We've mentioned it already, like the Bell Witch. I mean, you know, people have always equated that to a poltergeist type of activity, because it is more of a conscious type thing, a directed type of energy at one person.
Well, but many, many people experience.
Many people experience
her antics.
Right. Yeah,
some
yeah.
poltergeists are acting in a conscious way. These are called the type 2 poltergeists, or what I call directed RSPK. And then the other type is the simpler type, the type 1 poltergeist, which is called random RSPK. And this is where you just have random object movement. There aren't any patterns or attempt at communication and that sort of thing. But in the type 2 cases where there does appear to be an intelligence involved, I agree with you that there does appear to be an intelligence involved in mm-hmm. some poltergeist cases. But the question is this the intelligence of the deceased, or is this the unconscious intelligence of a living agent?
Yeah.
And in my opinion, it can always be traced to the unconscious intelligence. So it could be described as a conscious spirit or an intelligent spirit. But maybe it's the intelligent spirit of a living person's unconscious mind.
That's just making these things happen on the outside, so to say, as far as things flying around. Or
without even knowing it.
Because just as dreams are an attempt by the unconscious mind to send a message to your conscious mind, you see, a dream is a message to yourself from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Your unconscious mind sending a message to your conscious mind. And the goal of the conscious mind is to understand what the message is. Well, the poltergeist is also the unconscious mind sending a message to the conscious mind and sending a message to the conscious minds of others around us.
And that is all a result, I think. Well, not it, all of it, but it sounds like it goes back to what we talked about an hour ago, which is there is this glitch we've discussed where these things come through occasionally, and that's where we look at the poltergeist occurrences, so to say.
Yeah.
You know, we keep referring back. Doug, do you want to say something?
No, go ahead.
We keep referring back to Dreamo.
Yes.
We keep referring back to this, which I never thought in a million years we'd be talking about dreams. I thought we'd be talking about poltergeist the whole time. We've got into all types of
weird things.
Well,
that's
you know?
The thing. It all sort of intertwines and relates and
relates.
Well,
that's what I keep saying. I mean, my goals back when we started this thing back in like the 16th century was just that.
I have to say, the way that I learn mm-hmm. the best and the way that I draw many, many more parallels and lines in my own head is through stream of consciousness learning like this.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know,
this is like going and going and going. But it does come. It does come back around full circle. Well, but yeah,
and that's like I said. That's why I've changed my objectives. I mean, back when we started, doing this thing, myself was okay. I want to try to have experience. I want to try to gather some proof. But now I'm trying to figure out, Dr. Nichols, how it all relates. That's what and I've been saying that for years now, how it all kind of relates together.
Well, again, I think that, my feeling is, my hypothesis is, after 30 years of doing this kind of work, is that ghosts and hauntings are basically a type of exteriorized dream.
Yeah,
that there is a message involved. The message may be a very simple one, such as in the case of random RSPK, where you have an object that flies across the room maybe a few times. But there doesn't seem to be any communication. In this case, it's simply venting. It's simply letting off steam. It doesn't mean anything more than a teenager who throws a telephone across the room because they're mad at their boyfriend. It only means that they need to vent some of this emotional energy. So it's a form of self-therapy.
Okay.
Poltergeist is a form of self-therapy. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in the type 2 cases where you have much more complex interactions, and also in haunting cases where there appears to be complex interactions and communication involved, in those cases, then you have a more complex message. There is a message involved. For example, many people who are haunted just to give you an example, apparitions are more often seen by females than by males, but the apparitions that they see are more often of males. Now, the most common apparitions or haunting type apparitions are very often reported by females who are living alone, and many times they are living alone as the result of a recent divorce or separation or rupture of a relationship. And so, in those cases, the ghost is actually serving a purpose. The ghost is filling in for someone who's not there. So you see, these things actually do have a purpose.
And that makes a lot of sense. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that does make a lot of sense when you think about it.
So look at these cases as if you were looking at a dream, and then stop worrying so much about whether or not it can be physically documented, and start worrying about what does it mean? What is the meaning of it? And if you do that long enough, then I think you will come to the same conclusion that I have, and that is that the spirit world and the unconscious mind are one and the same.
Well, here's we keep referring back to dreams again. And that's why we talked about this in the break we took an hour ago. And this demands to be talked about, I think. And it's something, I know I mentioned it to you when we were on break, Dr. Nichols, and I really want to ask you about this because I have a friend. We're going to refer to him as a friend the whole time we talk about this. He was a friend, and
I love your story.
Thank you.
You don't talk about him like Skeletor.
Yeah, okay, we'll call him Skeletor.
no, that means taken. So you're
a friend. I have a friend, and this was back in our adolescent years, like between the ages of like, actually like 13.
Between the ages of, oh, what?
Well, like 13 to 16 around
okay.
there.
Okay.
I have a friend who, and we were talking about earlier, for example, and this ties right in with the whole dream thing, how our body is naturally paralyzed when we sleep so we don't act out our dreams. Now, the friend I have, this happened during the summer, and this particular friend, I used to spend the night at his house a lot. He used to spend the night at my house a lot. And one morning we woke up, and he had, Dr. Nichols, on the right side of his face, a scab that ran down. Right, it ran down on the outside of the eye by the temple area right there and ran a little bit under the eye, like under the eye itself.
Yes.
And I'm like, and it was fresh. It was still kind of a, you know, it was a fresh wound. It was starting to scab up and all that stuff. But it was a fresh wound. Like, I mean, he didn't have it the day before. Let's just say, let's make that very clear. He didn't have this. But we woke up, lo and behold, and there he has this wound on his face. It wasn't life-threatening. It was just, it was an abrasion, like he fell on the carpeting, right? And I'm like, well, that's pretty peculiar. You know, you okay, man? Oh, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. He just blew it off. A few nights later, just a couple of nights later, we both went to sleep, and we were at his house again. And we woke up, and I kid you not, Dr. Nichols, he had, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, per the dimensions, like measured, you know, perfectly, but he had a similar wound, like rug burn type thing, on the left side of his face.
Mm-hmm.
And it matched up. It was like, mm-hmm. It matched up around his eyes. Now, I think the key word here is it's sleepwalking, okay? But how in the world would he receive two wounds like that in the same areas on his face so they are symmetrical in that manner? Can you shed any light on that? I'm really curious.
Well, sure. I think there are two possibilities. I think both of them are absolutely possible, and in fact, I've seen both of them occur. One is the possibility that the person was not completely paralyzed during REM and actually did it themselves, basically, without realizing they had done it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this isn't that uncommon that a person hurts themselves while they're asleep.
Yeah.
The other possibility is that it was actually a psychogenic wound, that it's actually a psychosomatic eruption of the skin, which I've also seen. I've seen scratch marks appear on people's bodies in haunting and poltergeist cases. I've seen finger marks appear on people's necks. And I also had a patient a number of years ago who was a multiple personality who remembered being tied up and sadistically abused as a child. And under hypnosis, this person would have rope marks that would appear on their wrists and ankles.
Oh my God.
As they relived this experience. I have a video of a person who's under deep hypnosis who, when you put a cold coin on their arm and draw a circle around it and then tell them that the coin is red hot, it will blister, and 3 days later they have a scab there as if they were actually burned by hot metal.
Oh, my God.
So the mind is incredibly capable of affecting the physiology of the body, and the skin is an incredibly physiologically sensitive organ. I mean, we've all known people who had rashes, for example, from being nervous.
Uh-huh.
We know that warts are directly associated, although warts are caused by a herpes virus that's present in everyone's skin, they erupt due to stress conditions. And they can often be eliminated by stress reduction techniques or hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So the skin is incredibly sensitive. And, of course, we've all heard of stigmatics who bleed with the wound of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some cases, these things are physically caused, either deliberately, consciously, or unconsciously in a state of dissociation. And sometimes they are not deliberately caused. Sometimes they're caused purely by the mind's effect on the skin.
Well,
so I think either of those explanations would adequately explain that.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I have photographs of a girl who dreamed she was being mauled by a huge dog, and when she woke up, her whole face was covered with bruises that looked like dog bites.
Oh, my God.
I have that photo in my files.
Well, one of the things that we did was we went to the Sally House.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, in Kansas. Yeah.
In Kansas, and that's where the one fellow, the film crew was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, for the Sightings TV show, and and they filmed him, his stomach, you know, getting scratches on it.
Yeah.
Sure.
The stomach? Yeah.
Yeah, it was the stomach area.
You know, and Carrie Gaynor and Howard Heim, who are the two parapsychologists who investigated that case, particularly Carrie, are both friends of mine, and they both witnessed this occur, so I have no reason to think that it did not occur. And again, I've seen similar cases myself, so I know that it does occur, but I'm not inclined to explain it in terms of spirit interference because I know that the mind is perfectly capable of doing this. It's remarkable, yes. Supernatural, no.
Well, that's interesting. Like I said, I mean, these that I was referring to are perfectly symmetrical, and that's what had on, you know, where, of course, we were making fun of him because we're like 15 years old, but at the same time, we're like, you know, how could that happen, man? I mean, how do you get two symmetrical scab wounds on your face like that, you know, receiving one when you wake up one
very
day?
Very interesting. I wonder if in a way, the second one might have been caused by anxiety over the first one.
Possibly.
Which is actually a cruel, cruel irony.
Well,
I told you, too, that the film I've got of the person under hypnosis when you put the coin on their arm, mm-hmm. the resulting burn is perfectly symmetrical. It's exactly the size of the coin.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So the mind is capable not only of creating wounds, but of creating symmetrical wounds.
I didn't do anything, I swear to God. I had nothing. I didn't say anything to him in his sleep. I was perfectly asleep with him.
Did you know D. Scott Rogo?
Yes.
You've met him and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew Scott.
I have to say, when I was in college and rediscovering the paranormal, I read several books by D. Scott Rogo, and found him to be absolutely amazing, okay? What I want to know is, because it doesn't come through in his books, what was he like? What was his... not what was he like, but, you know, like, how was he at parties? No. What was his, like, outtake? Because he was really into it, into many different things, actually, and really into the paranormal and the out-of-body experiences and all this stuff. And then he also lived with what he said, I believe, unless this was a nasty rumor, he had had a premonition, which he didn't seem like the type who would... like to have a premonition, but he believed he had a premonition of his own death, and of course now we all know how he had passed away. So
yeah.
So what I'm wondering, and that's got to be a scary premonition to have. So I'm wondering, what was he like as a scientist and as a person? Because that's something we don't get out of books.
Well, I think he was certainly incredibly enthusiastic, incredibly smart, very intelligent man. Very talented. I think he is certainly one of the most, if not the most, significant popularizer of parapsychological research because he knew what he was writing about, unlike some of the other more popular writers that really are very thinly disguised spiritualists. I won't name any names, but some people who've written hundreds of books that are very popular who describe themselves as parapsychologists really aren't. Scott was a genuine parapsychologist. He attended the PA conferences. He was closely associated with the Southern California Society for Psychical Research, and he really knew what he was writing about. Now, on the downside, I think that sometimes his research was not as comprehensive as it should have been. There have mm-hmm. been several cases that he wrote about that have been pretty well debunked.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think by and large, he was extremely meticulous in his research and certainly tireless in his enthusiasm and energy. And so I certainly thought a great deal of him.
There you go, Doug.
Thank you. Because you don't get that kind of information out of, you know, reading the back jacket of a book or anything. So thank you, because I've been absolutely waiting for this interview. not specifically you, but waiting to find somebody who knew him, because I even though he's passed on and now knows what happens afterwards or not.
Yeah.
And we don't. I respect the work that he had done while he was here. So
I do, and I still enjoy reading his books. They're certainly one of the most enjoyable and one of the most user-friendly
mm-hmm.
types of writers in the paranormal. I often wish that I had his writing ability. So he certainly was a remarkable man, and unfortunately his early death was a great loss to parapsychology.
Was it true though that he speak of having a premonition of his own death?
He did not say that to me. I heard a simple kid talked about a premonition of his death. You know, the problem, again, with premonitions, though, and I'm fascinated with premonitions. In fact, I'm currently doing some research on premonitions. But the problem is, once again, you don't really know. The number of people who actually have premonitions of their own death is actually quite high. But the only time we ever notice it is when somebody actually dies.
It's kind of hard to verify, huh?
And then it's tough to verify.
Yeah, so it's difficult to say how valid that is. I mean, I do not know of any record that he left of details of this premonition that he had. I'm not familiar with any such record.
Right, the rumor...
So everything that I've heard is purely anecdotal, so, you know, I would certainly take it with a large grain of salt.
Well, I do too, but the rumor is that he specifically would not tell anybody and would not write it down.
But if that's the case, then that sort of eliminates any possible
any type of verification
for that information.
Right, yeah, exactly. and he specifically did not want that to be verified. So,
but you know, my from what I do know about Scott, that would surprise me. That sounds pretty apocryphal to me, because his goal was to validate and verify the paranormal, and if he thought he had a legitimate precognitive event or premonition, I think he would have recorded it, and he would have sealed it so that it, with instructions that it be opened at his death, because that would
right.
have provided additional evidence for the parapsychological database, and I think that was of foremost importance to him. So I'd be very surprised if he was that secretive about it, if the premonition was genuine.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
We've hit 9 o'clock.
Oh, unfortunately. I could go for days.
This has been such a treat.
Yes. Thank you, Doc. Thank you
Dr.
so much,
Nichols,
Dr. Nichols.
I can't even tell you how interesting this having you on has been.
And it's a very eye-opening. Very
eye-opening.
I think a lot of people are going to listen to this and go, whoa, hey, you know what? He has some very interesting points concerning what we're doing out there.
Finally, someone's making sense.
Well, yeah.
No,
thank you.
No, people
thank
do
you
make,
so much.
Yeah.
You, of course, are Dr. Andrew Nichols, PhD, of www.parapsychologylab.com.
And please read my book, everybody. It's called Ghost Detective, so if you don't mind, I'll put in a little plug.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Ghost Detective, Adventures of a Parapsychologist is a subtitle, and it is available at your local bookstore or through Amazon.com, et cetera, et cetera. So please read it.
We didn't get to talk about that. We talked about everything else.
Well, I think we got, you know, I have notes here on that, but it was just one of those things we got so far into what we were talking about. My mind got wound around node A over here when it should have been wound around node B over here.
Can we put a little link to the Amazon page?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We're going to put a link up.
We didn't get to talk about that. And we'll make it up to you, though, Dr. Nichols.
Thank you. So much.
Stay on the line for 1 second, Dr. Nichols. We're just going to close the show out, okay?
Okay.
Yes,
thanks.
But stay on the line for one moment.
Okay.
Everybody.
God.
This has been quite the brain burner.
Exhausting but rewarding, I think.
That's how it's
exhausting
been.
But rewarding. This is one of those shows, again, where we talk to someone and it's like the information takes over your body,
mm-hmm.
makes you froth at the mouth, makes your ears bleed, but at the end of the day you're going, wow, you know, I really learned something. And I hope everybody learned something from this.
And that's what we hope. For every listener, thank you very much.
Yeah.
For the guests and the folks who are on, thank
yeah.
you so much, Joel.
All of our affiliates, thank you.
Affiliates, thank you. This has been an honor and a pleasure to be hosting the show today.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be back next Sunday from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Oh, yeah.
I hope you set your clocks correctly, because we were on time today.
Yes, we
were. But we're out of time. We're cutting into Full Moon Radio.
We gotta go.
Full Moon Radio comes on immediately.
Sorry,
following Laura. Ghostly Talk. So, so everybody listen up, and everybody get on your iTunes and download her podcast if you don't already subscribe. Listen on OmniSound, listen on Pioneer.
I need to go someplace where a man can think.
Media.